From Seattle, Washington, the National Broadcasting Company, through the facilities of Station KOMO, brings you an address by the Honorable Robert A. Taft, Senator from Ohio. As the highlight of his Western tour, this evening has been chosen for his major address, in which he will speak on the much-discussed Taft-Hartley effort. The Senate leader arrived in Seattle earlier this afternoon, along with Mrs. Taft and many correspondents representing the leading wire services and newspapers throughout the country. The main Eagles Auditorium here in Seattle is filled to capacity with the Northwest citizens awaiting this address. We now present the Republican leader of the United States Senate, Senator Robert A. Taft. Senator Taft.
I have referred to the fact that the Republican Party has carried out its mandate in reducing expenses, in making every possible effort to reduce taxes, and in eliminating the regulations which hampered industry and individual in proceeding with their productive activities. The fourth mandate was to make some change in the labor law, which would improve the conditions existing in that field, which had seriously hampered the reconstruction of the United States. At the previous session, we had passed the Case Bill, which contains many of the provisions contained now in the so-called Taft-Hartley Bill. It was vetoed by the President, and everyone who voted for a Republican candidate knew that if we were elected, we would enact another bill along the same lines. In response to an overwhelming demand, the Labor Committees of Congress wrote the Labor Management Relations Act of 1947, and Congress passed it by a large vote in both houses. It was passed over the presidential veto on June 23, 1947, by a vote of 68 to 25 in the Senate and 331 to 83 in the House. More than half of all the Democratic members of Congress voted to override, as well as practically all of the Republicans. There would have been no such vote, ladies and gentlemen, if congressmen and senators had not known that their constituents were insisting upon such a labor bill. The violent propaganda of the labor union shows that either they do not know what is in the bill or they are deliberately deceiving their own members. Where the labor union members are advised of the bill's provisions, polls show that they are generally in favor of those particular provisions. Therefore, it is vitally important, first, that the public and particularly the employees know what is in the bill. In the beginning, the employer had all of the advantage in dealing with his employees. Before any of the laws were passed, he could discharge union organizers. He could insist upon a non-union shop and refuse to recognize any union. Then Congress enacted the Clayton Act, the Norris-LaGuardia Act, and the Wagner Act, to strengthen the employees and labor unions against arbitrary action by their employers. The first two acts practically abolished court injunctions and relieved unions of responsibility for the acts of their agents. But they made no distinction regarding the character of a strike or its purpose, so that as a practical matter, it wiped out all legal remedies against strikes of any kind. The Wagner Act, of course, ladies and gentlemen, the whole propaganda against the Taft-Hartley Act relies upon silencing the arguments in favor of that act. The Wagner Act provided that employees were entitled to deal with the employer, speaking as one man through their representative, chosen by a majority of all of the employees. It was right and necessary that bargaining between employers and employees be put on an equal basis. Unfortunately, the Wagner Act went further than that because it was completely one-sided by giving special privileges to the employees against their employer and no rights whatever to the employer. He had to bargain collectively through to the signing of the written contract. The union was under no such obligation. The employer could be brought before the board for unfair labor practices. The union could not. The result was that the unions were given legal protection to take almost any action which did not constitute a breach of the peace, and all strikes were encouraged and protected. The limit was reached when the Supreme Court decided that the acts prohibiting extortion and racketeering were not applicable to labor unions if used in support of labor union purposes. When arbitrary power is granted to anyone, sooner or later it will be used. And powers granted by these acts were soon used by a few arbitrary labor leaders to accomplish results far outside of the real purposes of these acts. The acts were drafted in broad language, and their effect was expanded by regulations of the board and court decisions far beyond the intentions of Congress. The labor leaders became so powerful that they dominated their own men, and employers also, except for the largest companies, were at their mercy. Almost any strike was sanctioned by the courts, and no remedy was provided for the employer or for the public. The new act attempts to deal with particular abuses and restore an equality of bargaining power. It is criticized as being complicated. That is principally because it amends the Wagner Act, and the Wagner Act is complicated, particularly when overlaid by a long series of decisions by the board and by the courts. Labor relations themselves are complicated and vary from one industry to another. The amendments in this law to the Wagner Act attempt to make the law fair to both sides. I sat through the hearings of the Act in 1939, and I can say that at that time even, no such perversions of justice have ever occurred in the United States as occurred under the first board. While President Roosevelt later had to replace that board, many of the early constructions on procedure and interpretation were utterly one-sided. The new act puts collective bargaining on the basis of equality. The union, like the employer, is required to refrain from coercion against its members. It is required to bargain collectively and sign a contract. How ridiculous is the present position of the labor leaders? For years, they have insisted that the employer must deal with the union and sign a contract with the union instead of with the individual man. Now they say that the union need not sign such a contract and should not be liable on it because it may possibly be harassed by suits. Everyone else in the United States may be harassed by suits. Why not unions? Of course. Of course, if that argument were any good, there could be no legal responsibility on anybody for damage to somebody else. The Act regulates representation elections and gives the employer the right to have an election when he is uncertain who the representative of the majority is. Up to now, only the union could ask for an election, and any employer dealt at his peril with a labor union leader claiming to control a majority of his men, whether he control them or not. The new act gives freedom of speech to employer and employee. Under the old law, the board undertook to prohibit any arguments by an employer. I remember when the chairman of the board testified before our committee that in his opinion, it was an unfair labor practice for an employer to say that labor organizers were communists when they were in fact communists. The Act forbids strikes for 60 days after notice is given of an intention to change the contract. Polls show that 70% of the union members favor such a provision. In numerous procedural matters, the board set up rules unduly discriminating against the employer. A number of these, not all, have been corrected. The bill constitutes a bill of rights for union members. Many of the provisions of the Act are intended to give protection to the individual employees, both union and non-union members, against arbitrary action by labor union officials. First, a union shop cannot be imposed on the men unless a majority of the employees vote for it. Even then, a man who is willing to pay his dues cannot be excluded from a job because the union arbitrarily refuses to admit him or fires him after he is admitted for some cause other than non-payment of dues. Unless we change the present law, men today cannot work at their chosen occupations in many industries except by favor of labor union leaders, no matter how excellent workmen they may be. Third, the closed shop is entirely forbidden. That is, a man does not have to be a member of the union when first employed, but only after 30 days where a union shop has been established by vote. Fourth, the board is given power to prohibit excessive or discriminatory dues. Fifth, unions are required to file financial reports with their members and an account of their methods of election and procedure. 85% of union members, according to the polls, favor such a provision. Sixth, employees cannot be coerced by a labor union to join or not join the union. Seventh, dues may not be checked off from an employee's wages unless he has filed a written consent. Eighth, if a welfare fund is established out of funds which otherwise could have been paid in wages, the employee is entitled to have those funds treated as trust funds, administered equally for his benefit and properly supervised and audited. Ninth. Union members are entitled to protest against the use of their dues contributed for union purposes to defeat candidates whom they may favor in any national election. It is fair to say that for the first time, Congress has interested itself in protecting the liberties of the individual workman, subject, of course, always to his being bound by a majority vote in choosing the representative who makes the contract for wages, hours, and other working conditions. There are other important provisions to protect employers and the public. The Act forbids jurisdictional strikes and secondary boycotts because both of them impose unjust hardships on innocent third parties. No witness appeared before our committees to defend either of these racketeering practices. It was suggested that there were some good kinds of secondary boycotts. When we asked them to describe them, no one was able to describe them in any legal language that anyone could understand. Second, in the case of a nationwide strike affecting the national safety or health, the president is given power after the appointment of a board of inquiry to enjoin the strike for 80 days, while further attempts are made to bring the parties together and a vote is finally held before a strike can be undertaken. I personally do not like to limit the right to strike for legitimate purposes, but where the whole nation is concerned, it seems reasonable to ask the employer and the men to maintain the status quo for such a short period. As a matter of fact, the public demands much more. I do not think they realize the implication, however, of a complete prohibition of the right to strike. To prohibit the right to strike for better wages, hours, or working conditions would require the setting up of a government board to fix wages, hours, and other conditions in case of a dispute, or else some form of compulsory arbitration which would have about the same effect. The very possibility of such an adjudication would lead one party or the other to delay the process of collective bargaining because he would think he might get a better treatment from the government board. Even more important, the process would soon amount to a government fixing of wages and the fixing of a wage pattern for the country. If that is done, the government will be called on properly to go on and fix prices and then regulate distribution, which must follow the fixing of prices. I do not believe we can maintain the system of free competition in this country unless there is a right to strike when no agreement can be reached. A prohibition of that right would lead to a completely regimented economy. The Act also sets up a mediation service which should enable the government more effectively to protect the rights of the public by insisting that every peaceable means be taken to settle labor disputes before the public is subjected to the inconvenience and hardship which a strike may bring. One principle of the act is to impose on labor unions a responsibility commensurate with their new power. Unions are bound to be powerful and should be powerful, and they will remain so for many years to come, regardless of this or any other law. They are big business today. They pay their executives the salaries of businessmen. They set up huge organizations. They spend millions of dollars in propaganda. Certainly, they should be subject to the same responsibility as corporations. And that is what this act does. It makes them liable on their contracts by suits in the federal courts. It requires financial reports to be made by the officers to their members. It requires that they use union funds for union purposes and not to engage in politics. For years, corporations have been refused the right to use stockholders' money contributed for business purposes to favor particular political candidates. Unions clearly should not be able to use for such purposes funds contributed in dues for the legitimate activities of union bargaining. The Act requires that welfare funds be administered equally for the benefit of all members and properly supervised. The Act does not, in any way, limit the legitimate rights of labor unions or any of the rights upon which they have laid such stress in the past. The talk about a slave labor bill is ridiculous when you read the express provision of the Act, which will be favored by any court, which says, quote, "Nothing shall be construed to require an individual employee to render labor service without his consent, nor shall anything in this act be construed to make the quitting of his labor by an individual employee an illegal act, nor shall any court issue any process to compel the performance by an individual employee of such labor or service without his consent." End of quote. The restraints of the acts are directed entirely at the acts of unions through their duly elected officers. What has really upset some of the union leaders is not the enslavement of their men, but the very reasonable restraints on their hitherto unrestrained and arbitrary power over both their men and the public. The Act does not require any man to work for a wage fixed by the government or by compulsory arbitration. The Act does not deprive the unions of any right of collective bargaining conferred by the Wagner Act. As stated in a recent bulletin of the AFL itself, the five employer unfair labor practices contained in Section 8 of the original Wagner Act, the Magna Carta of Labor, as they have been called, are repeated in the same language in the new Act. Therefore, the rights of the unions to collective bargaining and to insist upon recognition are unimpaired. Fourth, there is nothing in the Act which restores in any way the right of individual employers to go to federal courts and secure injunctions against strikes. The employer, like the union, can appeal to the National Labor Relations Board to prevent those strikes which do not have a proper purpose. But injunctions can be granted only upon application by the government. No restraint is imposed. No restraint is imposed upon nationwide bargaining, even though it may be in the nature of a monopoly. Finally, we have set up a joint committee to study further the whole problem of labor-management relations and to follow carefully the operation of the Act. It may well be that some of the provisions will not apply properly to particular situations or particular industries. In that case, the committee will invite labor and management to propose amendments. We'll hold hearings on those proposals and recommend such amendments as it considers necessary to correct mistakes, if any, eliminate ambiguities, or change provisions which do not seem to be working out as intended. I have tried to list the essential provisions of the bill to show that it is reasonably directed to reduce strikes correct injustices, and put employers and employees on a basis of equality. It is a fair, mild, and reasonable bill. I wish union members and the public would compare the careful reservation of fundamental rights in this law with the Truman proposal of 1946. The president asked for authority in any important strike to have the government seize plants and facilities and operate them for the profit of the government, to draft employees into the army on any terms he chose to impose, to draft labor leaders into the army and put them to work or in concentration camps, and completely to suppress every fundamental right of both labor unions and men. The president attempted to force that bill through both houses of Congress in one night, although both railroad and coal strikes had been settled. Coal strike not completely so, but everyone knew that it was in course of settlement. It is fair to point out that it was on my objection that this action was prevented, and on my motion that the authority to draft men into the army was later stricken from the bill in the Senate. I have tried to describe fairly the bill which has been the subject of the most violent propaganda by labor unions. The CIO called it a wrecked labor bill, a ripper law to gut unions, treason, crucifixion, butcher shop legislation. The AFL, in its more conservative way, has referred to it as evil, vicious, offensive, infamous, and reprehensible. They have threatened to spend millions of dollars to defeat every senator and congressman who voted for it. Of course, they do not specify the particular matters to which they object, because if they did, their arguments could be easily answered, and the labor union members themselves would be even more in favor of the specific provisions of the act. My object is to bring to their attention what these provisions really are through the maze of propaganda and vituperation. In the recent Pennsylvania election, in an industrial district, the Democratic candidate made this bill the issue of the campaign. The Republican candidate won by the biggest majority and the biggest percentage of vote obtained by any Republican in that district in the last 15 years. Apparently, if labor union leadership is the sole issue of an election, the people will be overwhelmingly in favor of defeating the effort of labor union leaders to dominate the government. This attitude on the part of the public is the fault of the labor union officials themselves. The abuses of the Wagner Act were clearly testified to as long ago as 1939. Amendments then could have checked these abuses, but the big labor unions chose to oppose the slightest amendment to any labor law. They have suppressed in committee for many years every effort to report out a bill dealing with labor relations. They have threatened with political extinction anyone who supported any amendments to labor legislation. They gave our committee no cooperation whatever in trying to find the proper solution. Now they feel compelled to carry on a campaign of misrepresentation which no longer deceives even their own members. Even officers of labor unions today are beginning to speak out in favor of giving the law a trial and then appealing to Congress for any reasonable amendments that then appear to be necessary. If you will ask the labor leaders who actually do the negotiating for their unions with the sole interest of promoting the interests of their own members, they will tell you that there is nothing in the bill which interferes with their proper and normal method of negotiating with their employer or with any reasonable result which they are trying to obtain. I noticed today that John E. Hoy, president and business agent of the Northern Berkshire Textile Council in Massachusetts, representing 1,000 workers, said this week that he finds nothing wrong whatever with the law. An independent labor leader in Western Massachusetts says that the law has taken every working man and woman out of the concentration camps of certain labor unions. I note also that there has been a steady decline of strikes from 235 on June 25th to 134 on September 3rd. Some labor union leaders seek publicity by attempting to defy the law and it is suggested that thereby they will discredit the law. Thus, some have refused to sign anti-communist affidavits. Of course, the only result of that refusal is to deprive their unions and their members of the privileges conferred on unions by the Wagner Act. There is no nullification of the new act. Their action would simply repeal the Wagner Act for their own members, a far more drastic anti-union result than anything contained in the new act. The union leaders only put themselves in a ridiculous and unpopular position. They have told us that communist infiltration into unions is the most dangerous communist weapon in the United States. The public and the union members want to get rid of communist officers. Yet supposedly, despite the Taft-Hartley Act, these labor leaders refuse to cooperate in getting rid of communists. Every government employee has to file an anti-communist affidavit. I had to file an anti-communist affidavit myself during the war. It is said that certain contracts made by employers exempt labor unions from liability for their own acts in violation of law. Of course, the law does not attempt to say what shall be contained in collective bargaining contracts except to prohibit certain provisions which infringe on the rights of individual labor members. In fact, the whole act is based on free collective bargaining, which means the ability of the employer and union to make such contracts as they see fit to make. If the union refuses to make or be bound by a contract, it constitutes an unfair labor practice, but only if the employer chooses to file the charge. By filing the charge, he may force the making of a real contract. If the contract is not made, the union will be deprived of the benefits of the Wagner Act, and its power to strike effectively will be substantially diminished. There is nothing illegal in a contract exempting the union from liability, but if it refuses to make such a contract, to make a fair contract, which does impose liability, it will surrender rights which most unions have found to be exceedingly valuable. I have little doubt that in time unions will find it to their own advantage to comply with the spirit of the Act and with the provisions of the Act. Until that time, as long as they refuse to comply with those provisions, they are the only sufferers from the political issue which they are trying to make. The issues of labor relations are infinite and complicated. They should be worked out on the basis of logic and reason, and they will be so worked out if the labor union leaders will recognize that the people of the United States are supreme over labor union leaders today, just as they made themselves supreme over business barons and financial leaders in days past. If the Republican Congress had refused to pass this law over the president's veto, it would have been an admission that the labor union leaders were bigger than the government. Every man who voted for the law is entitled to the gratitude of those who wish to maintain a government without special privileges and with liberty and justice for all.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've just heard an address by the Honorable Robert A. Taft, Republican Senator from Ohio. As a highlight of the Senate leader's Western tour, this discussion of the Taft-Hartley Act came to you from the Eagles Auditorium in Seattle, Washington. It was broadcast through the facilities of station KOMO. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.